everyone, and welcome to the Screen Strong Families podcast, bringing you the best solutions for parents who are serious about finally eliminating screen problems in their home. This is Melanie Hempe, and if you are one of our regular listeners, we want to welcome you back. And if you're a new friend, we're so glad you found us. Our guest today is Susan Lynn, the author of Who's Raising the Kids? And I love this title, and we'll give you the fuller, bigger title here in a minute, but I love this title, this part of the title, Who's Raising the Kids? Because this title is so screen strong. This has been one of our biggest initiatives over here, is to get parents to take back their kids and just take back their leadership role in their home. I really believe that one of the biggest invisible risks that parents face with childhood screen overuse is the relinquishing of our kids to the virtual world and to the virtual parent, I call it. I feel like when my oldest son, we did this. We were struggling with his gaming dependency right under our nose. And I did not understand what was happening, and that one of the most dangerous things that was happening was not in the game itself, as far as the content and all the crazy stuff going on there. It was the fact that he was becoming detached from our family. We were losing him to another family, and it wasn't a real family, as you know, it was a fake world. But he actually, before our eyes, sort of did this transition when he was in high school, and it just broke my heart. And at the time, I had no idea what was happening. I knew that teenagers, you know, were supposed to act independent and act like they didn't like their family, but that's not really true. But what I didn't understand is how he was being raised by his peers and by the forces that be behind that screen. So the problem with childhood screen use, there's many problems, but the biggest, in my opinion, after almost 10 years in this space, is this detachment disorder that we're experiencing. And when we look at not only entertainment screen media, but we're looking at all the commercialism as well, with all the, and it starts so early. So what I have learned is that kids will bond with the things that they spend the most time with. And if it's not your family, it will be something else. Because as Susan points out in her book, all kids are looking for something to glom onto. So Susan, I could go on and on with all my stories, but let's just get started. I'm just dying to dive in to your brain and for you to help us and just all my parents out there that are struggling with different issues at different ages. And I know that you are going to talk to us today even more about the younger brain and the younger kids. Susan, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks, Melanie. I'm so happy to be talking to you. And I'm really interested in the way that you framed this, actually, that the notion of another family, that's what screen time kind of can provide. I think what's important for parents to understand, for us all to understand, is that it's not, I mean, you said it was a fake family, I think, but actually what it is a corporation.
Yeah.
And that it's a corporation or a conglomerate whose only interest in your child is to make money from them by monetizing their attention. And I think that it's really important that it's not just that it's a screen, it's the business model of the people who own the businesses who put things on that screen, that's what the real problem is.
Yeah. Oh no, you're exactly right. And you have spent years and years and years in this space. Let's start with that really quick, Susan. Can you tell us a bit about your background? I know about your background, but just explain to our audience your background and don't be shy. And and just go ahead and start with that and what your work is today.
Okay. So I began life as a ventriloquist and I earned my living that way. for a lot of my life. I worked with Fred Rogers. I was on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and also made videotapes with his production company about difficult issues for kids. So I did that. I became a psychologist and I morphed into an activist beginning in 1998. I was raising a child at home, so I could see the impact of commercialism then on her school. I walked into her school and the spring concert was an evening of Disney music.
Oh, yeah.
I was the only parent who was upset about that, but the idea that there was school supposed to be a place that expands kids' horizons, and they were doing a concert based on music that she was being sold on a daily basis. Mm. And I was also working with kids, very young children, and in fact, it was a four-year-old who introduced me to Britney Spears.
Oh my goodness.
So there was a lot of things going on that heightened my concern about commercialism. But then what really changed me from a concerned parent, a psychologist, to an activist was Teletubbies. When PBS imported Teletubbies and claimed from Britain and claimed that it was educational for babies as young as one, that was kind of the last straw for me.
Wow.
I was working with a psychiatrist at a media center that was housed at a children's mental health center. And we wrote an article for the American Prospect that talked about the real trouble with Teletubbies. That was when Jerry Falwell was saying that Teletubbies was terrible because Tinky Winky carried a purse and was therefore gay. But our point was that Teletubbies' sexual orientation wasn't the issue. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that kids' babies were being exploited in order to sell them Teletubbies products. So from there, that's how I and some colleagues founded Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, which has become Fair Play. And it all started then.
Wow. So you were just really on the ground floor of the development in just the history, right? You've experienced the history of the evolution of kids and screens and how what you're referring to, the commercial nature. And this is why toddlers, I'm sure, as young as, 2 and 3, started begging their parents for Teletubby stuff, right?
Yes. I mean, that's the whole purpose, really, of so many programs for children today is to sell them, on characters. And then the characters are on toys and clothing and food and, and all of that.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a Trojan horse. It's just here, yeah. We're going to tell you that we're going to make your baby smarter because, what parent doesn't want to sign up for that, right? And then, but instead what we're going to do, in fact, we don't really even care if your baby's getting smarter because we know they're not really getting smarter, but we're going to tell you that so we can monetize this experience. And they know that with screen time, it is the perfect way to do it because, what parent out there doesn't understand the babysitter nature of screens for kids.
Right. And also, when I began this work, it was television. And that seems so quaint now. Television. But television is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
It's a, great force for selling people things. But today, the new technologies are so much more powerful. And the fact that, they are gathering information about who's on their sites and what they're doing, both online and offline, means that they can personalize advertising. Mm. They can make it what they call interactive. And mm-hmm. it's you know, just however powerful television was, this is so much more so. And it's only going to get increasingly powerful.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, talk about that just for a second, because I in my workshops and talking to parent groups, I make a very clear distinction between, I mean, there are some very clear, similar things, of course, but between a TV experience and online gaming or social media experience, or, you know, it is like on just a whole different level. And can you right. just explain, since I know this so well, like the back of your hand, can you explain just what happens between, you know, because TV, when your child is watching Mr. Rogers, what's happening versus when they are interacting in that iPad or interacting on a game, a video game?
First of all, it depends on the content, at least for older children. Mm-hmm. So let's start out just though with babies and toddlers. And there's a huge push to get babies in front of screens.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to YouTube, there are, you know, just, and you just search for videos for babies, there are tons of them,
yeah,
all claiming to educate babies. And in fact, or most claiming anyway, and in fact, babies can't learn anything useful from a screen.
Wow.
What the research is showing is that babies need to learn in the context of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Babies are primed for relationships. We have a new baby in my family. My daughter, you know, now has a 6-month-old. And I was amazed holding that baby when she was just a few weeks old and how intensely she was focused on my face.
Wow. Yeah. So
for neurotypical babies, they're just primed to develop an attachment to their caregivers. And putting a baby in front of a screen, A, it's not useful, and B, it interferes with that relationship.
Wow.
Now, one thing I do want to be clear about is that I understand the value of video chatting with relatives who love, you know, who love that baby and live
sure.
far away. So I understand that. And I'm not, you know, at all suggesting that parents shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm. But there are limits to that too, obviously.
Sure. There, of course there are, because, you know, every time you've got a baby with the screen, essentially what we're doing is training babies to turn to screens for stimulation and soothing instead mm-hmm. of encouraging them to turn to what the tech world calls in real life, IRL, to turn, you know, to what's happening in real life and to turn to the real people in their lives.
Mm-hmm. So the difference in the TV passively sort of entertaining your kid and a screen is the stimulation factor is one thing that's different.
I don't think of television as passive.
Uh-huh.
I think that we call it passive because when digital entertainment started and video games and ed tech and all of that was happening, the marketers for that needed to wean parents away from television. And so they, you know, what they did is, you know, promote how great the interaction was and, you know, denigrate the experience a child might have on television by calling it passive.
Oh.
Passive and active. But in fact, you know, for, again, not for babies and toddlers, but for a 4-year-old to be watching a really good story on television, that's not terrible for them. A good story can help kids think about the world, expand their world. You know, it's not passive, really.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, the by calling everything that a child does online or on an iPad or a phone, calling that interactive, it's really a misnomer. What it is reactive mostly, because what kids often encounter on a screen is stimulation that has specific answers. The answers are already pre-programmed. I mean, apps that are you know, supposed to promote creativity, there's a limited number of choices actually that kids have.
True.
That's not, you know, as creative as, for instance, crayons and paper.
I see exactly what you're saying. Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, and there are things, you know, programs for kids, again, not babies and toddlers, that can be really interactive, but they're not the ones that most people use or that most kids use. They're, you know, they're not big money makers.
So to touch real quick back on what we were, just to wrap up this whole concept of babies learning on screens. I know there's a lot of YouTube influencers, I guess you'll call them right now today, that have YouTube channels that promise that your baby is learning things. And we do get questions about this. And of course, I always say, and I know that you agree, that learning is happens best with mom face-to-face, volleying back and forth, not with the child propped up in a car seat on an iPad. That is, you know, watching another figure. But why is it, and what do you think? And of course, there's a lot of ads tied to all that too. So now that's, I'm just drawing all that here. I'm drawing the lines between the dots here as you talk, that the reason why these things are so popular is because they're pushed with this false promise that we're teaching your child. But then a mom will call me and say, well, you know, but my toddler learned his colors doing this, you know, so it's really frustrating because I know that it is not the best way for kids to learn. But I want to just find out from you, just since you've been in the space for so long, just speak into that a little bit. What is it about that that's not the best thing for them, and what could they be doing better?
Babies and toddlers and young children, they learn with all of their senses.
Yeah.
And a screen doesn't provide that opportunity, right? I mean, a screen is visual and oral, but, you know, there's not touch or smell or taste. So that's limiting. And actually, it's, I mean, babies, what the research is showing is that babies really aren't learning anything useful on the screen. So why that baby might have learned colors is because the mom was there, you know, saying, oh, red, or the dad, you know, the parent, red, blue, you know, doing it. So it's the parent interaction.
Right.
But if parents are interacting with babies and toddlers, they could be interacting with them around a book or a hands-on toy that doesn't, you know, talk or sing or dance or, you know, whatever.
Right. Right.
So it's really, I mean, what we know a lot about babies and how they learn. And one of the things that we know is that they learn, well, actually several things. They learn with all of their senses, and it's absolutely essential for them to be in a loving, caring, active relationship with an adult or adults who love them.
Mm-hmm. I love the quote in your book. I jotted this quote down when you're talking about a toddler, and you said she's playing in a safe space in the presence of someone who loves her, with access to objects to invite her to use them as she wishes instead of dictating how they should be played with. As a result, she gets to experience curiosity and then the satisfaction of figuring out on her own the answer she's looking for. She gets to experience very manageable failure and then persevere until she completes the task. And you were in the first part here of the book. I just jumped, you know, out of my chair when I was reading this part, because the story of the baby exploring the baby doll was so powerful to me. I have four children. I've been there. I get it. I understand. And if you could just in your own words, just talk about that a second, how this toddler would look at the baby doll's ears and then touch her own ears. And it yeah. is, that was so powerful to me. Talk about that a minute.
Yeah. So that was my cousin's 14-month-old granddaughter. She sent me that video of that you're talking about. And honestly, I when I saw it, I just got chills.
Yeah.
And I still get chills when I think about it.
I'm so getting chills right now. You talking about it. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's not the flu.
Okay. Okay, good.
So Ariel, 14 months old, was sitting on a blanket with what are thought of as old retro boring toys, a stuffed bear, an old baby doll. And she's mouthing the doll, and her hands are kind of wandering, you know, and around the doll's body, and they come to the doll's fingers. And she feels the fingers, and then she puts her hand up to her ear. And it's almost like you could see, can see her thinking protuberances.
Yeah.
Or, you know, things that stick out, whatever. Right. And right. So, but she takes her hand down from her ear. She's not satisfied. And then her hand wanders up the doll's body, and she feels the doll's ear, and she feels her own ear. She feels the doll's ear again, and then she feels both of her ears. And she does it one more time, and then she just goes on to something else. And that is an astonishing capture of human learning.
Yeah.
I mean, that there is that baby gets an idea of something that interests her. And it's, is my body like this doll's body? And it's amazing to think that at, you know, a very young age, that babies can recognize basically a sculpture of a human body as wow. a human body, and to identify it or want to explore whether is that like me. It was just so extraordinary.
Well, and when I read it, I totally felt what you must have felt too when you saw that video, because that really captures in such a way the essence of what is missing on screen entertainment and screen what we think we are calling learning. It's not that it's all bad, but this is what's missing. And for children, toddlers, preschoolers, middle schoolers, this is still all super important for them. That ability to put their hands and learn and get that feedback, what you're talking about with all the senses, it's right. impossible on a screen.
To experience curiosity and experience what it's like to satisfy that curiosity,
yeah.
to have an idea of something that you want to do and then doing it. And one of the problems with most of the commercial apps that I see is that they tell children what to do. They tell children what's important, you know, and what do we want for children? I mean, aside from wanting them, you know, to be kind and love. I mean, those are so important. But also we want them to be curious. We want mm-hmm. them to feel competent to satisfy that curiosity. We want them to love learning. They're not getting that from most of the apps and the learning apps that I've seen. That's not what they're getting.
It's all just like halfway. I mean, it's not even close. It's just counterfeit. And I also think that the other point that you made was so good right after this part in the book, that children's lives are like stunted if they're chronically hungry, frightened, hurt, or unloved. And so the reason why that toddler felt so free to explore and learn was because all of her needs were met. She wasn't starving. She wasn't cold. She wasn't scared, right? And so those needs have to be met first. And I look at this always in the lens of even older kids too. And I feel like that continues all the way through adolescence, that there has to be a sense of calm and peace for learning to really take hold. And we are scaring our kids to death by putting them on social media and putting them all these crazy, scary games. And it's affecting every aspect of their life. But I love that you brought that up. I think that teenagers are equally as hungry emotionally, and they're being malnourished in a way.
We're all, all human beings are hungry for love and companionship.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, that follows us through our lives, really. So, but one of the problems is that what happens online, what these companies are doing is basically they're fighting a war for our attention, and it's our attention at all costs. So the content or the quality of the content, that doesn't matter to the big conglomerates. What they want is our attention. And so what often gets our attention and keeps us are things that are unusual or intense or scary or that, yeah. that you know, foment great anger or fear or envy.
Yeah.
So there, you know, there is a lot of negativity that captures our attention and holds us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for adults, it's true for teenagers, and it's true for little kids.
Yeah, because it works. It's right. The formula. So in here, I read a little section that I really like, this one statement that you said, that the experiences young children have influence their brain development, and the experiences that young children don't have also influence their brain development. That's brilliant. because it's not just what they're doing, but it's what's missing. And that is in our work that we do, what we always want to bring to the top of the discussion. It's not only what they're doing, but it's what they're not doing.
Right.
And we know that in young brains, that the connections that are not used and that are not repeated are the ones that get pruned away, right? And the ones that are repeated, the things that you do allow your child to do, will get strengthened. And this, again, is a truth that doesn't change. This truth doesn't change with the times. It doesn't change with the next best video game that comes out. It is still the truth. So yeah. If your toddler is getting used to being in front of an iPad for hours a day, the areas of their brain that provide, the connections for that curiosity, they're going to get pruned away, and your child will be less curious. I think they will be less apt to pick up that baby doll and figure out the ears. I think, as they get older, they're going to be less curious to do a lot of things. They're going to be more driven to do what's on the screen, because this is just how our brains are wired. So thank you so much for bringing that up in here.
No, sure. I mean, I think that, that understanding something of human development is helpful if you're a parent.
Yes.
To understand what's appropriate for a baby or a toddler, and to understand that a baby is not two, like a 2-year-old. a 2-year-old is not like a 5-year-old. A 5-year-old is not like a 9-year-old. A 9-year-old is not like a 15-year-old. But one of the things that that marketers in the tech industry do is that they market to younger children as if they were older children.
Mm.
And that's exploiting, you know, a developmental characteristic of children, which is that they look up to older kids and admire them and want to be like them. So, you know, 5-year-olds want to be like 12-year-olds. 12-year-olds want to be like 19-year-olds. But, you know, they don't have the cognitive capacity or the judgment to grapple with the kinds of things that older kids are having to grapple with.
No, they're, and this brain development that you're talking about is what ScreenStrong is all about. We want to educate parents on brain development, and we want to educate, you know, teenagers on brain development, because we know that with a little bit of knowledge, you know, that comes a lot of power. And so our student course, we have a brand new student course. It was just released, and it goes through in very simple terms all these things that you're touching on here, or many of the things that you're touching on in your book. And it didn't used to be that way, Susan. It used to be, you know, our moms could just open the back door and we'd all run out and play, and we'd come home when the streetlights came on, and little did our parents know that that was exactly what our brains needed. But now, since we have all these distractions and big, big money and big corporations coming in to monetize, you know, our kids' attention, and they're doing it very well, now we have to learn about this brain development. And when you know your why, it is so much easier to manage all this. You have to understand why. And that's why ScreenStrong exists, to provide that education to parents, you know. And again, this year we're actually explaining it to middle school kids. So I can't wait to even show you more about that. Let's talk about a topic real quick that's really close to my heart. And it's the one about language development. And you have this in your book, that language development as early as, what, 18 months predicts academic success later, and, you know, language acquisition and all of that, and that all that language acquisition is inherently social. And this is social in the sense, not social media, but of course it is social with parents face-to-face, with people face-to-face talking. And I thought it was really interesting, because we get a lot of comments and questions about this that you brought up about reading on eBooks. So when your child has an iPad in front of them, and maybe you're trying to read a book to them, I thought it was interesting that you brought up the fact that parents are actually talking less when they have the screen present, as opposed to if you have a paper book, as a parent, you're going to be embellishing and talking and asking questions and, you know, look at the bear and look at the kitty, and it's different. I thought that was really interesting. And I love doing these podcasts because I learn so much every time I do one. But can you talk about that just a minute, about how screens reduce that spoken word?
Yeah. And that kind of sort of fits in with what we've been talking about. You know, what the research shows is that babies can't learn language from a machine. So any app that says it teaches your baby, it will learn to speak, that's not true. Babies learn to speak in relationship with a human being. That's how they learn to speak. And then what the people trying to sell parents on eBooks are saying is, you know, that the eBooks with a lot of bells and whistles, you know, where thing birds cheap, if you swipe them or tap them or whatever, that it's more interactive. But actually what happens is what you said, that there's not as much conversation, but the conversation that does take place isn't conversation that promotes literacy. Conversation that promotes literacy is about the story and the characters and what do you think of this and that kind of thing. But the conversation, what research has shown that parents have with kids with an ebook with bells and whistles, is push this, touch this, you know, it's more mechanical. It's not, it's about the device and how to use it. It's not about the story itself. And then you know, the argument was that ebooks are, that don't have those kinds of bells and whistles, are just the same as regular books. But what the research is suggesting or showing is that parents reading an ebook with the child, they don't cuddle as much. An iPad doesn't lend itself to cuddling the way that a book does.
Yeah.
And also there are an iPhone and an iPad or a tablet, they're designed for individual use. They're hard actually to use with somebody else. And so there's a lot of back and forth about where the device is. Again, instead of talking about a story. So, the tech industry tries to, say that, books are so passe and we don't need books anymore and a screen is just as good, if not better, but that doesn't seem to be true for young children.
Mm-hmm. That is so powerful. It's so great for people like you to be out there writing books like this, explain this to these young parents, because they just don't know. And it's not that they don't want to know, they just don't know. And it just seems like everybody's doing it and every toddler has an iPad. And it seems like I can just, sit down and read the book. But, as you're talking, I'm thinking with an iPad, I got to hold it with both hands, right? With a book, I can hold it with one hand and put my arm around my baby, right? So you have to have both hands. It's super hard to even navigate it. You can't hold it and then turn the page.
That's a really good point.
That's why, and I never even thought about that, but that's the extra problem.
I hadn't thought about it that way either. That's a really good point. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for parents today. It's a really hard time to be a parent today for a lot of reasons, but one of them is this toxic commercial culture, digitized, commercialized culture, and what's being pushed on them. And it's not that I'm anti-screen. I mean, I worked Fred Rogers on television, and I made videos about difficult issues for kids. Again, not babies and toddlers. But it's that the screens today are so compelling and designed to be addictive. And like 5 minutes in front of a screen is not going to ruin a baby's brain. But the problem is that it's almost never just 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's so powerful that it's so tempting to, say, well, I can get things done if my baby's in front of a screen.
I mean,
we don't have universal childcare, which, we need. And a lot of parents are really struggling, and I have a lot of empathy for that.
Yeah.
But one thing maybe, to think about is that the more screen time that young children have, the more they're likely to use it when they're older.
Yes.
Because they haven't experienced the, the wonders of in real life.
Yeah.
Of the world around them. And I think that's, really concerning. And a lot of people are very judgmental of parents. And in my book, I really try to talk about how hard it is to be a parent today. And also, I do provide a lot of, suggestions for things that parents can do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that this is not a family problem, it's a societal problem, and it needs a societal fix. But social change takes a lot of time, and I recognize that parents need help now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was, you know, really glad to be able to include a chapter of suggestions for parents.
Right. Well, and they need help now, and I believe that they really need education, and it just has to start with education. It has right. to. You have to have education, and then community. And then when you get those things going, then change will happen. But it will not happen without those two things. You look at the smoking industry. We had to get educated. We had to start educating kids in school. And then the community grows and says, okay, wait, this isn't good. Hey, my kids aren't going to smoke. How about you? Your kids aren't going to smoke. It all happens. It all starts with education. And that's what you're doing in your book. And I just love it so much. So let's dive in just a couple more things before we run out of time. I want to have you just speak a little bit about the money that is made in video games, Fortnite, Minecraft. Explain just in a few sentences. I know you got the whole book on it over here, but just so parents can understand this commercialism, the commercial issues that are going on with this and the money that's being made, just billions of dollars that are being made in this industry. But explain, you know, that Fortnite, right, is a sandbox game, whatever, but it's not like a real sandbox because everything is monetized in there and they're selling status symbols, right? Because think about it. When you're in middle school, you want to be famous. You want to be popular. Like that's why you wake up every day. You're trying to be funny. You're trying to get attention. You're trying to, and Fortnite knows that. And they are monetizing child development is what they're doing. They're monetizing right. the weaknesses in certain stages of child development. I think that's a fair thing to say. So I never will forget the day that I learned that people were actually spending real money on virtual fake things. It blew my mind. It just blew my mind.
Yeah. You know, I mean, first of all, I think what you said is so true that, you know, that games like Fortnite, where kids can play with other kids online, that it's not like a sandbox, because in a sandbox, nobody is directing a child's play. And also, as you said, nobody's trying to monetize
right.
what you're doing. So, you know, it's a good marketing term, but it, in fact, it's not an accurate analogy. You know, Fortnite, Minecraft, you know, they started, they're called freemiums because you can play the game at a basic level. But what the companies are banking on is that kids will want the things that are marketed to them as they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Fortnite, for instance, it's what they call skins, being able to decorate their avatar. And that changes frequently, actually, where a new pack will come out with accessories for your avatar. And so kids can see, based on, you know, what the avatars look like or dressed in or whatever, they can see who has money and who doesn't have money,
who's wow.
allow them to buy these things and who doesn't. And so they do, they play on envy and longing. And kids are concrete. They're young kids are anyway, they're not so good at abstractions. So what they see is important to them. And so it sets up this thing where a parent may think at the beginning that they're providing a free game for their child, but basically what the companies are doing is encouraging kids to nag their parents to spend money, as you say, to buy these, you know, virtual things.
Wow. I have never thought of it that way. I mean, I've never drawn that conclusion, but you are spot on. It is training them in allowing them to practice envy, right? And comparison, even in a video game. And I never thought of it that way, but you're exactly right. If your friend's character has $100 worth of cool equipment and skins, they're going to have more social collateral in the game. And that's the problem with middle school kids, especially. They're constantly looking for social collateral because they are concrete. They don't understand what really matters in life is not the clothes that you're wearing. You know, even on a video game, that's just kind of blowing my mind here, how you just pulled that comparison. It's exactly what's happening. And that's why it's so successful. You just follow the brain development of a 10-year-old kid, and you follow the money, and you've got all the answers that you need.
You know, the other thing is that kids are being taught when in most of the apps and games that I've seen, what they're being taught is that the experience of playing isn't enough. What's important is what you get.
Yes.
So even what seems like a benign practice of giving kids stars, for instance, like in a lot of ed tech games, if kids get the right answer, they get stars or they get applause. But those external rewards actually aren't really beneficial for developing good habits around learning or around
school. Interesting. It kind of takes the focus off the point.
Right. And in fact, there are studies, you know, that suggest that giving kids rewards for doing a particular task, even something that's fun, that experience of getting a reward afterwards, what starts to happen is that the kids don't want to do the thing anymore.
Yeah.
Unless they get a reward.
Yeah. And you have that whole thing, that whole concept explained here in the book. So if anyone listening wants to hear more about how that works, you've got it very well researched and explained in here. And I'm not gonna let this podcast end without picking up on the word that you mentioned a few minutes ago. And the word is nag. And I was so fascinated in reading about the nag factor. I mean, look, I have four children. I could write a book on nagging, right? For real. I could. I know all the tricks. I know all the things. And this, what you have written in here, the pester power. So I didn't know this was a thing. Like, I didn't understand how products were so designed around this pester power.
Yeah, the purpose of marketing to kids. I mean, they're like once and future consumers. And one purpose is to get them to nag their parents for products. And this, you know, in 2004, when my first book came out, the marketers were just very clear about this, that's what they, you know, they're very upfront. We want little Susie to nag her parents because otherwise, you know, her mom won't buy funky purple ketchup. I mean, I'm not kidding. It's not an exact quote, but I pretty much got the quote down, and there really was funky purple ketchup, which I think they don't make anymore. And so I was completely shocked also when I first heard about it, that they actually, you know, did a study on nagging, and it wasn't to help parents to cope with nagging. It was to help corporations help children nag more effectively.
Oh my goodness. So, well, I think my kids took all those courses, whatever they did.
Yeah. Yeah. And nagging, you know, and then what, you know, the tech industry, what corporate heads say, they say parents should just say no. But, you know, it's not that easy to say no.
No.
I mean, and it's true, we need to be able to say no to our kids. But it's exhausting to be nagged to over and over and over and over again. It's hard. And also, it gets all mixed up with our feelings about what we wanted when we were kids and whether yeah. those needs were met and, you know, whether we
oh, yeah.
were popular when we were kids or yes. whether, you know, we had enough money or we felt like we didn't. And you know, we want our kids to be happy. So I, you know, yes, it's, you know, we need to be able to say no to kids. And children do need to learn that when we say no, we really mean no.
Yeah. But it is all tied into our own personal emotional experiences in childhood. And, you know, we remember the day that our mom said no to the Barbie doll. So now that flashback comes across and we're like, well, I know that pain. I remember that pain. So I'm going to say yes. And I think that it's interesting, the statistic that 77%, I'm trying to think of this from memory that you had in your book, 77% ask and 74% give in. The nagging really works.
It does. It's extremely effective.
And then you had a quote that young kids and teens wield $1.2 trillion in annual purchasing power. And that's based on nagging. I'm telling you, it's based on nagging. If nagging didn't work, that number would be way low.
Right. No, that, yeah. And also, if nagging didn't work, it's unlikely we would have so much online advertising targeting kids.
Correct. And the way that this nag factor works, if you're listening, please read about this more. But the way that it works is they take in consideration not just the doll or the product or the game itself, but they take in consideration how can, you know, we package this, because packaging, I think, really affects the nagging factor.
Yes.
And how we can embed that nagging factor, if you will. Now, I know they don't call it that anymore because I think they were probably feeling pretty bad. So what do they call it now? Collaborative decision making with your kids or something? Like, that's a really funny thing just in itself. That could be a whole nother podcast about why we don't collaborate with children when we're adults. That they're not adults. Anyway, that's a whole nother thing. That makes me crazy. You know, we're their coach. The player doesn't tell the coach how to run the team. But anyway, how they are now calling it collaborative decision making because they're trying to make it sound better. Because guys, listen, if you're listening, like this is a thing. Like this is a thing. Like they're out there, you know, people are out there. I mean, this is not a conspiracy. Okay. This is a business practice. You have to figure out how to get the kid to nag about the game, about the phone. And then, you know, you're going to sell more. And oh my goodness. I mean, all the smartphone companies are just jumping up and down, right? Because the nag factor around a smartphone, are you kidding? It's out the roof. I mean,
right.
Every kid is going to nag their parents about that. So I don't want to keep beating this dead horse, but I love reading about that. And I love just learning about that. So let's scoot on because we got to wrap up here in just a second. What I want to quickly dive into here is just on page 132, you were talking about how devices disrupt families and all these things, the persuasive design, the addictive properties, the brilliant marketing. I love this one, the capacity to give us what we think we want. Love that. Because it's yeah. not really what we want, but it's what we think that we want. And then, of course, the data surveillance. That's the other thing. That's how all this is disruptive for families. And then you talk about how corporate sponsors, you know, on iPads in schools, and I never thought about this, how the big corporations are coming in to advertise to our kids on the school screens, and they all pay lots and lots and lots of money to have their product flash in front of our kids all day at school. Never even thought about that. So I love this quote, Rachel Franz, I believe it was, navigating technology for children can be overwhelming. The truth is your child doesn't need apps to keep up, catch up, or get ahead. I love that. You have the full power to limit or say no to screen time. I love that. And it has to start in preschool because I know for a fact that little gamers grow up to be big gamers. It has to go all the way through middle school, and you have to really put your armor on because it's going to have to go mostly through high school too. I mean, you're going to have to say no to certain things, and we have to stop pretending that we have to keep up with everyone around us. The kids are going to be way more ahead if they can spend these years doing what they need to do in the real world first. So, Susan, thank you so much for writing this book. I know how much work goes into it. And what I want to do is close with the 6 principles of child development that help parents make screen decisions. I thought these were brilliant. So I'm going to read each one and then you can comment if you want. But the first one, young children live and learn in the context of social development.
Yes, that's what we've been talking about. And it starts with babies.
And I love that. That's where they live. That's where they learn. It has to be social. The second one is young children use their whole bodies and their all their senses to learn about the world.
And that is why smartphones, tablets are not really good learning tools for young children.
Mm-hmm. The third one is children learn best and benefit most from direct firsthand experiences in the world of actual relationships and objects. I love this one.
Yeah, they need to be able to manipulate, you know, with things that are around them. And again, you know, we're back to relationships. That's what's really key.
Mm-hmm.
To not just to learning, but to becoming a full person in this world.
And the ability to pick up that baby doll and touch your ear and touch that baby doll's ear. You have to do that. That's how you learn. The fourth one is young children are active learners who learn by inventing ideas. And this one, Susan, let me tell you, I get tears in my eyes on this one.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that most of the apps that I've seen for kids, that they don't let children invent. The person who made the game or the app invented. But mostly what they do is give kids choices for things, limit their options, tell them what they should do, tell them what's wrong without letting kids do that themselves.
And none of this will happen if they don't have the time and space for it. And that is called boredom. And this is where all this innovation comes from. It doesn't come from being distracted.
Right. And thank you to my colleague, Nancy Carlson Page, for those principles.
Oh, good. Yes. Yes.
That's why I included them in the book.
And children build resilience and coping skills through play.
Yeah, that's something. It would be fun to have another conversation just about play. We didn't talk about it a lot, but
yeah.
Play is the foundation of learning, creativity, constructive problem solving, the capacity to wrestle with life to make it meaningful. That's how kids, you know, learn how to be in the world. Mm-hmm. And we're depriving children of that.
And then the final one is children make sense of the world through play. They figure out their coping skills through play, but they also make sense of the world where they're not so confused and lost and anxious and depressed. It all starts making sense in the physical
world.
Yeah,
I've spent a lot of years doing play therapy with puppets, with kids coping with hospitalization and really death and loss, you know, chronic illnesses, all sorts of things. And kids allowed to play creatively. We create out of our experiences. Mm-hmm. And so often, if left, you know, to their own devices, kids will play about what's going on in their lives. And often they take the role of the powerful people in their lives who are making decisions. And that's, it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And also it provides an incredible window for us into their hearts and minds.
So let's wrap up. Susan, can you give our audience some encouragement today? I always ask my guests this because it can be overwhelming and we hear all this information like a fire hose. It comes in and now we have the mom and dad that are getting ready to move on in their day and in their week and they have to sit with all this. So how can you encourage families to start making a difference in their own lives and not regret what they've done maybe in the past.
So one thing that I'm really optimistic about is that there's more activism around this issue and more information being provided to parents by people like you, Melanie, and Screen Strong. So there are a lot more resources than there were when my colleagues and I started, mm-hmm. Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood or Fair Play. And also that there are things that you can do. You're not helpless in this environment. I'm not underestimating the power of technology or the marketing, but there are things like you that you can do that would make a difference. Screen-free meals, setting limits on screens, watching your own screen use mm-hmm. when you're with your kids. Mm-hmm. Turn off your notifications so that you're not constantly interrupted when you're with your children.
Yeah, and I think the biggest encouragement that we can offer is to, or the tip, I guess, for parents is to fill your life with all the things that you love and that you want, and the time with family and the outdoor play and reading the real books, and fill your life first with all of that before you even allow screens to come into the mix, because screens will be like, just a child having a fit. They get all the attention, right? When they're having a screaming fit on the kitchen floor. So you want to just fill your cup first with all the good things that you want, and then use screens to enhance that. Use screens to sit down and watch a family movie, but don't use screens as the thing to try to enhance those core things that you want for your family. And this book is very helpful to not only get the facts straight, but when I finish reading it, I just feel so inspired. And so, Susan, thank you so much for being an inspiration for me and for allowing me to share you and your wonderful wisdom with the world. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Melanie. It was really great to talk with you.
So what's your homework today? If you want the best way to explain the science around screens to your kids, because you may be thinking, oh, if my kids could only understand this, then you want to get our student course. It is so fabulous. It looks like a graphic novel. Your kids are going to love it. It's available to large groups. It's available to small groups or individually. And you want to get Susan's book, Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business in the Lives of Children. And we will have that in the show notes that you can click on. Remember, we've got your back and we are here to help you. So until next time, stand up for your kids. And don't forget to get our student course, of course. Stand out from the crowd and stay strong.